Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Caroline Fredrickson, President of the American Constitution Society, who examines Attorney General William Barr's summary of the Mueller report and the drive to ensure the full Mueller report is released to the public. John Quigley, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University, who takes a critical look at President Trump's decision to ignore international law in recognizing Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights, and speakers at a rally in New Haven declaring their solidarity with the 50 Muslim worshippers shot and killed by a white supremacist gunman in Christchurch, New Zealand on March 15th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Nearly 2 years after Islamic State fighters were driven out of Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, despair and frustration are building. Wide swaths of the city were leveled during urban fighting between ISIS and Iraqi army troops. The city now desperately needs $2 billion in reconstruction funds. A $50 million project to rebuild the historic Great Mosque of Al-Nuri is underway, financed by the United Arab Emirates. But reconstruction is generally mired in bureaucracy, corruption, and security threats from remaining ISIS cells in Sunni communities across Iraq. Soon after Mosul was freed from ISIS control, 75% of Iraqis in liberated Sunni-dominated regions felt the country was going in the right direction. Now, only a quarter of those polled say Iraq is on the right path. In fact, the Christian Science Monitor reports that there is growing concern among Iraqis, Western officials, and aid groups alike that the lack of palpable progress in Mosul and in several Sunni-dominated provinces risks rekindling the anti-government, pro-ISIS ideology. 1 year after Facebook was confronted with questions about when its senior executives knew about Cambridge Analytica's abuse of users' data, the social media giant agreed on March 19th to overhaul its lucrative targeted advertising system. The agreement addresses accusations that landlords, lenders, and employers use the platform to discriminate, a significant shift for a company that built a business empire on selling personal data. The settlement requires Facebook to withhold a wide variety of demographic data, such as gender, age, and zip codes, from advertisers who market housing and employment opportunities. The Washington Post reports that Facebook has also agreed to undertake a major overhaul of the platform's software and create a new portal limiting how advertisers for credit, housing, and jobs can micro-target their audiences. Civil rights advocates have warned for years that Facebook's ads violated anti-discrimination laws because advertisers were able to use the data to exclude African Americans, women, seniors, people with disabilities, and others. The legacy of racism, a key element in the war on drugs, is complicating initiatives to legalize the recreational use of marijuana in states like New York and Georgia. African American legislators are insisting on access to the lucrative cannabis market for communities which suffered the most during the nationwide crackdown on illegal drugs. Even as decriminalization of small amounts of marijuana take hold in Georgia, that southern state, along with Texas and New Jersey, lead the nation in the number of marijuana arrests. African Americans are nearly four times as likely to be arrested for possession of cannabis as whites, despite similar patterns of use. Even in Colorado, where marijuana was legalized in 2014, blacks account for three-quarters of those arrested for underage or public use of marijuana. Racial disparity in drug arrests goes back to the 1930s, when the commissioner of the Federal Department of Narcotics, Harry Anslinger, blamed crazed minorities for marijuana use. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill. Woo!
After it was announced that Special Counsel Robert Mueller had finished his investigation into Trump campaign collusion with Russia, Attorney General William Barr released a summary of Mueller's final report on March 24th. Barr's summary of the report says the special counsel found no evidence that the president or his campaign colluded with Russia, but left open the question of President Trump's culpability for obstruction of justice. While the White House and Republicans are claiming victory, Democrats are demanding that the full report be made public, along with the documents upon which the investigation is based. Glaring questions remain about the relationship between Trump campaign officials and Russians linked to the Kremlin, and why they routinely lied about their contacts. And despite the headlines about the Mueller report's findings, investigations continue into the Trump Organization's role in hush money payments, the Trump Inaugural Committee's finances, questions on how Trump's son-in-law and daughter got security clearances, and evidence of ethical violations in Trump's foundation and business. Your reporter spoke with Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, who takes a critical look at how Attorney General William Barr summarized the Mueller report and the importance of ensuring the Mueller report is released to the public and Congress begins to investigate the many unanswered questions about the president's conduct.
I mean, first we have to, you know, make sure everybody understands we have not seen the Mueller report. And what Bill Barr seems to have done is he decided to substitute his own judgment for Robert Mueller. We have a situation where Robert Mueller apparently decided there was a lot of evidence of obstruction, but he decided not to make an ultimate determination of guilt, but, you know, clear there was a lot of evidence in favor. So he left that particular piece undecided, although he said there were serious issues of law and fact, and the president was not exonerated. Then Bill Barr takes Mueller's report, writes a short letter to send to Congress and says, I've decided that there's not going to be any kind of prosecution here. And so basically puts himself in the shoes of Bob Mueller, even though this is a man who auditioned for the job as attorney general by writing the president a letter saying, I don't think the president could ever be subject to prosecution for obstruction of justice. So, you know, there raises all sorts of issues about whether this was a whitewashing. You know, what did Bob Mueller really find? And it really makes it clear that Congress absolutely has to get a hold of the Mueller report, look at the evidence, and really understand why it was that Bob Mueller found so much evidence in favor of obstruction.
Carolyn, what do you make of the media coverage of this letter written by Attorney General Barr and its conclusions there? Have they simplified it to the point where many people around the country will have misinformation about what the Mueller report actually said? Much of it, we still don't know.
No question about it. Many of the reports say, you know, no finding of wrongdoing and things like that, which is clearly not even what Barr's letter says. Barr's letter says they were very, you know, if you read between the lines, you know that Mueller found some really troubling evidence and ultimately did not come to a conclusion. When it comes to the conspiracy, does not say there was no evidence, but says that they did not establish a basis for a prosecution. First of all, we don't know what standard of proof they were applying in this case. Is it the highest level, which is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is when you go to a jury and you want to get a conviction? Or was it what is more appropriate when you're trying to get an indictment, which is the stage at the beginning of a prosecution, knowing that you're going to be going back, getting more witnesses and getting more evidence? So was it at that stage? And that standard of proof is much lower and would have been the appropriate one. So, you know, we don't know, did Barr apply a too high standard of proof to move forward? You know, what were Mueller's findings? Did they look at all of the different aspects of the relationships between the Russians and the Trump family, the Trump campaign, the Trump companies, and so forth? Or was it only a subset, the way that the letter makes it sound like it's only a subset of the interactions? It makes plain why it's so important for Congress to play its role, its appropriate role under Article 1 of the Constitution, which is to serve as a check on the other branches to do oversight. And you know, so they really need to take a look. We all, as Americans, we have the right to know what happened.
Caroline, explain to our audience a bit about the narrow mission that Bob Mueller came into this assignment with, and more importantly, what issues were out of his purview that are still squarely on the table and should be investigated by Congress?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, you know, it was really the Russian interference in our election and the possible conspiracy with the Trump campaign. Very narrowly construed as well. At least in Barr's letter, they don't mention at all. He doesn't mention the quid pro quo aspects of the relationship with Russia, which is, you know, for example, getting information on Hillary Clinton that could have been damaging, that was damaging to her campaign, the giving up of polling information to the Russians. All of that seems to have been excluded, or certainly wasn't mentioned in Barr's letter. All they looked at were the two incidents where you had the Russians hacking and leaking the DNC emails. And then the other aspect was the use of Russian trolls and bots to distribute fake news to influence the elections. Very, very, very narrow. And so that leaves a lot of questions about, you know, what about the giving up of polling and information and so forth. But then there's that whole other set of issues around the Trump family and Donald Trump himself exploiting the presidency for personal gain, something that is not only unusual, but certainly raises a lot of questions legally. And you have maybe a dozen other, investigations that are ongoing and involving the Trump Foundation, Trump campaign finance violations. He is individual number one, named in the Michael Cohen prosecution in the Southern District of New York. You've got issues of tax fraud being investigated by the Attorney General of New York, insurance fraud, and so forth. So the whole set of other investigations that are ongoing, not to mention the ongoing U.S. attorney processes in the Eastern District of Virginia and in Washington, D.C., involving Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, and so forth. So there's a lot still out there, and this is only a phase of the overall investigation into Donald Trump and his family and his inappropriate dealings with respect to the American fisc. The Emoluments Clause lawsuits are still pending, so lots still to go.
That was Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society. For more perspectives on the Mueller investigation, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After tweeting his intention to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights on March 21st, President Trump, standing alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House, signed a proclamation making the U.S. policy shift official 4 days later on March 25th. Trump's move reverses the position that Democratic and Republican administrations have held for more than 50 years. Many observers believe Trump timed his decision on the Golan Heights to support Netanyahu, who faces a tough re-election fight in Israel on April 9th. Israel's military captured the Golan Heights from Syria during the 1967 Six-Day War. In 1981, the Israeli government annexed the territory, where it now serves as a strategic military and agricultural outpost. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres dismissed Trump's proclamation as worthless because annexation of territory by force is prohibited under international law. Trump's new policy on the Golan Heights follows earlier decisions advocated by Netanyahu, including recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital and the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran International Nuclear Agreement. Your reporter spoke with John Quigley, professor emeritus of international law at Ohio State University, who takes a critical look at Mr. Trump's decision to ignore international law in recognizing Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights.
There isn't anything going on right now that relates to the Golan Heights that would have prompted President Trump to do this. That is, the Syrian government is not, you know, presently making any military preparations to take it back. Israel has not been planning to do anything on the ground or with respect to claims that President Trump might be responding to. The general assessment, which I share, is that President Trump did it because he thought it would help President Netanyahu in the elections that are coming up in a couple of weeks in Israel, that it would kind of solidify President Trump and the United States' support for Netanyahu and make him look more like a successful leader, and that would explain why he did that.
John, what are your concerns long-term about the precedent this may set for international law, if it sets any precedent, regarding captured territory being permanently annexed by the power that took control of disputed territory?
Well, that is a rather firm principle in international law, that if you take territory in warfare, you don't get title to it. But that seems to be what Mr. Trump has gone for in this situation. Mr. Trump doesn't seem to be concerned, you know, I think in general in his actions about the consequences and about setting precedents. This is simply a statement by President Trump that, in his view, Israel has sovereignty. That doesn't mean that it will necessarily be the position of the United States for all time. If a Democrat wins the next election, there could well be a statement countering what President Trump is saying.
What do you expect the reaction of the people of the Middle East will be to this move, following Trump's earlier decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel?
Now, I think that the reaction on the part of the peoples is likely to be quite strong. And I think a real problem for the United States, as it is now pulling out of Syria and is beginning to worry about ISIS carrying out attacks in Europe or the United States, this certainly gives ISIS a very nice recruiting tool. You know, I think that the peoples in the region are going to be quite upset with the United States over doing this. Even within Syria, I think all of the factions in Syria are united. If Trump wanted to unite the factions in Syria, this was a pretty good way to do it, because they all think that Golan is part of Syria, whether you're the president of Syria, or whether you're the so-called democratic opposition, whether you're ISIS, you know, you name it, al-Nusra Front, they are united on this issue.
When Russia annexed Crimea, there was an outcry from the United States and many other countries around the world, and you've written about this subject. What, if any, impact will Trump's decision here on recognizing Israel's control of the Golan Heights that had belonged to Syria when it comes to other disputes about land takeovers, such as Crimea?
Yeah, I think it does make it more difficult for Trump to take a position against Russia in relation to Crimea. Certainly, you know, if he, you know, now comes out with a strong tweet against Russia on Crimea, this is going to be thrown back in his face. With respect to Crimea, at least, you know, Russia has a plausible approach or plausible position with respect to Crimea, that is, that it has an argument that Crimea should be under Russian sovereignty. With respect to Golan, there is no argument at all for Israel, other than the fact that strategically it might be handy to hold it, which is not much of an argument.
That was John Quigley, Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's recognition of Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
In the wake of the murder of 50 Muslim worshippers at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand on March 15th, people around the world gathered in solidarity to rally against hate and Islamophobia. The 28-year-old Australian man charged with a mass murder left behind writings that detail his white supremacist worldview, claiming inspiration from Charleston church shooter Dylan Roof to Norwegian terrorist Anders Breivik. The shooter also refers to U.S. President Donald Trump as, quote, a symbol of renewed white identity and common purpose. In Connecticut, a dozen people gathered on the New Haven Green on March 20th for a rally organized by a group called Muslim Youth of Connecticut and the Refugee Resettlement Organization IRIS, or Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. As participants at the rally held photos of some of those murdered, speaker after speaker denounced the attacks on people at worship, not only Muslims, but Christians, Jews, Sikhs, and others from world religions. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the rally and recorded the comments of three speakers. We hear first from Zain Sayal with Muslim Youth of Connecticut, the main organizer of the gathering.
Our 50 brothers and sisters that were cold-bloodedly murdered with their loved ones in the middle of connecting with their Creator in a house that is not meant for bullets. No house of worship should have to look over the shoulder at the least. Mosques, churches, synagogues, you think they are safe havens. None of these shootings were any more or less important. No life is more valuable than the other. What bothers me the most are the leaders in the world instilling the hatred and the fear into these killers' hearts. Those responsible for breeding this generation of right-wing extremists, the Australian white terrorist manifest included, the president of this country. And my question to all of you is, why are we afraid to call out Trump for what he is? How many more attacks on Muslims or churches or synagogues is it going to take for making them responsible for what they have done?
That was Zain Sayal with Muslim Youth of Connecticut. Another speaker was Fahd Syed, a Muslim community activist from Waterbury, Connecticut.
I'll be honest, I'm going to keep it real. That's how I grew up. I want to highlight some of the bigot agenda, and we're going to be traveling the world to see what's going on. First, let me discuss on what when Israel became the so-called capital of Jerusalem. This led to ongoing racism, as the Palestinians are being removed from their homes. Dogs are being sick on them. They are stopping prayers in Masjid al-Aqsa, murder and destruction of our schools. Imagine if your family owned a home for hundreds of years and suddenly soldiers tell you to get out. Where would you go? There's nowhere to go. Their Palestinian crimes are guarding their movement, the only reason why they were moved. Now let's take a trip to China, where at least the millions of Muslims are being locked up, put in prison for being Muslim, forcibly being fed pork, being killed, being tortured, nails removed with tools, Muslims' wives being touched forcibly by other men. Where is Congress attempting to stop this mass torture to Muslims in China? Now let's take a trip to this country, where Donald Trump called for a Muslim ban and called Islam a disease, attacking many minority communities and inspiring terrorist white supremacists, which led to the killing of many minority communities, which includes the Black community, the Jewish community, the Muslim community, and attacks on the Hispanic community. Now let's take a trip to Congress, where bigots continue to attack my beloved sister, Congresswoman Ilhan, where AIPAC have funded politicians to endorse the Muslim ban. Shame on those that stay silent. Please, brothers and sisters, continue praying in your mosque. I hear our community literally crying and screaming in pain from all the bigots' incidents. I share your pain. Remember, we seek help from God alone and only alone in His guidance. Salaam alaikum.
That was Fahd Syed, an activist from Waterbury, Connecticut. Saifuddin Hassan, an assistant imam at Masjid al-Islam in New Haven, also spoke.
Today, we want to show our solidarity with our brothers and sisters there, the brothers and sisters who have been massacred in New Zealand, Our brothers and sisters who have been massacred in Pittsburgh, in the synagogue. Our brothers and sisters who were massacred in South Carolina. These are the same hateful people. And we're not just talking about non-Muslims. We're talking about any Muslim, because it is forbid for us to go into a place of worship or kill any innocent human being. Brothers and sisters, we have a president who didn't even really apologize or didn't even show sympathy for what happened in New Zealand. And I want to say that we are all immigrants. Every last one of us who have come to this country, beside the natives of this country, we are all immigrants. All the people of New Zealand, besides the indigenous people who were systematically wiped out in New Zealand, who were systematically wiped out in the Americas and in the Aborigines in Australia. We are all immigrants, so how can someone come up and say they are invaders? But this is the rhetoric that we're constantly hearing from the president of our country, that there are invaders coming in. I know my brothers and sisters who have come from other countries. They came here for a better life, and they wouldn't give that up for anything. They escaped persecution and tyranny in our own Muslim countries to come here, and they wouldn't give that up for anything. So, brothers and sisters, I ask you to stand in solidarity with all of us today, because I'm touched. And this has touched the hearts of all of the Muslim community, that all of you have come out today and throughout the world and have showed your solidarity against hate and racism and terrorism and all of these acts of aggression against humanity. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
That was Saifuddin Hassan, an assistant imam at New Haven's Masjid al-Islam Mosque, speaking at a solidarity rally for the 50 victims of a white supremacist shooter in New Zealand on March 15th. Learn more about how diverse communities are making common cause against racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and white supremacy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on eJazz Radio in Kampala, Uganda, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KSER in Everett, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.